Committee will come to order. Representative Doty, would you move the minutes?
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of the minutes for March 3rd, 2010, as printed.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Representative Norris? Representative Doty, would you move the bill?
Madam Chair, I move House File 3188 to be recommended to pass and to be placed on the general register.
Representative Norris, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe this is the first time I've been in front of your committee, so.
I think so.
I look forward to this opportunity. Madam Chair and members, I bring this resolution to you on behalf of a constituent of mine who lives in House District 10A. And he's urging this passage, which will send a message to our congressional delegation from Minnesota to support two pieces of legislation that are now waiting to be acted on. One is H.R. 2254, and Senate file is 1939, again in the U.S. Congress. As of now, there are 200 House members that have signed on as co-sponsors of the House bill. 14 senators have signed on so far. My constituent served in Vietnam. In fact, he served two tours of duty off the shores of Vietnam. He was in the Navy, served on the USS Gridley. 3 years ago, Mike was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. He's gone through a transplant at the Mayo Clinic, and the good news is that he's doing good. That was back in 2007. He applied for a veteran's disability because of this condition, and this multiple myeloma is a presumptive illness. His ship was exposed to Agent Orange while in Vietnam. However, because he wasn't on the ground, didn't have boots on the ground, the VA will not allow him or any of the Blue Water Navy or Air Force personnel to get benefits they believe are earned. So by introducing this resolution, we are helping this one constituent and all of the Navy and Air Force personnel who believe that they have benefits that are due to them. Madam Chair, I'm not sure this is the first resolution that I've ever presented, so I don't think there's any need to read it to you. If there are questions.
Any questions? Any testifiers? Representative, you have to get a different name.
Is this home run?
Yeah.
Can I do that?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Norris, for bringing this bill forward. Just a question out of curiosity. Do we have an estimate of how many Navy or Air Force personnel may have a valid claim in respect to this resolution?
Representative Szymanski, Madam Chair, I do not have a number. It's available. Probably I should, before this moves much further, maybe I'll try and get that number.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Doty?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 3188 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Did you want
to
talk?
No.
Okay.
No, about this bill.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Representative Doty, would you move the bill?
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 3262 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in, no, Colin, oh, there he is. I did it too fast. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I don't know if anybody's going to speak on behalf. Basically, this bill is a cleanup bill from a couple instances that happened up in Kitson County and other areas, and only clarifies that we added on to the bill that the county law enforcement officer can also do the first investigation because they're on duty more than, since there's a regulation requiring 24-hour action, the county law enforcement officer is the actual one that's on more likely to be available during that time than anybody else. So we added that. And the other thing is to clarify that it's really the university's extension officer or USDA that will actually make the compensation recommendations. And that's basically all the bill does.
Any questions? Any testifiers? If not,
no, somebody is coming up.
Madam Chair, for the record, Major Rodman Smith, DNR Enforcement Operations Manager. And I was asked by the Commissioner's Office to come over here today and offer some, to maybe have some changes in some of the language in this bill that we'd like to be able to have cleaned up just a little bit if possible, if this is the appropriate venue for that.
Do you have an amendment?
I don't intend to present one. In fact, I'll oppose one.
Madam Chair? Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, maybe you could help us a little bit because it sounds like there's not an amendment that's prepared in writing, which would give us a chance to review it. Of course, these might be minor changes, but I was wondering, Madam Chair, where this bill is going next and whether the amendment could be presented in that committee or whether this bill should be held to get a written amendment. So, Madam Chair, this is going to agricultural finance next. Maybe we could at least have, the Major? Maybe the Major could at least explain what the amendment is. We could get a sense of whether we can act on the amendment or not. But, Major, I would say it's hard to deal with the oral amendments.
Yeah, you can let him speak. I will indicate my concern for having him here is it would be nice if DNR had contacted me before I walked into this room. I have no idea what this amendment's purpose is.
So Madam Chair, if we could hear from the Major about what the amendments might be.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, just to clarify that on page 2, lines 2.5, that the agent, that's the county extension agent, and add a conservation, after agent on line 2.5 would basically add conservation officer or USDA APHIS representative. I think it's spelled out United States Department of Agriculture, Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service official. And then line 2.6, after payment, insert the language based on a physical evidence of wolf damage, then period. And just to ensure that there's some physical evidence that there was actually wolf damage.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would be then to the Major. If I understand the section correctly, we have the recommendation. If you turn back on 1.202 over through 2.1, we have the folks that you just mentioned will make a personal inspection of the site. They report to the commissioner the results of the inspection. Then the commissioner, if you turn over to 2.1, will determine whether the livestock was destroyed. And then the section you're looking at is the authorization of payment. Are you meaning to focus only on the authorization of payment and including these other folks?
Madam Chair, Representative, it would be for the, you're correct, for the authorization of payment, and then so that is also that the authorization payment is based on actual physical evidence of wolf damage.
Madam Chair, if I might continue, but if I look at lines 2.2 and 2.3, the commissioner is making a decision based on the recommendations of the folks you just mentioned, shall determine whether the livestock was destroyed by a gray wolf. So it sounds like that determination is being made in the previous sentence. You're focusing on the authorization of payments.
Madam Chair, Representative, it would appear so, yes.
So, Madam Chair, I'm confused as to why any amendment would be needed. It sounds like it's already included in the language that Representative Olin is presenting to us today. I don't mean to be direct or brusque. I'm just trying to be clear.
Representative Erdahl?
Well, Madam Chair, I think we should at least make sure from the major and from Representative Olin, is it clear that we don't need an amendment now, Major?
Madam Chair, Representative, I would have to go back and talk with my folks, I guess.
I'm done.
Representative?
I believe it would be easier to pass it out of this committee, and if there is something they really want to say, they can come to my office and try to work out some wording before it gets on the Ag Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Olin or Major. Anyone have a number on how much money is paid out each year for a gray wolf depredation?
I believe that would have to be answered by the Department of Ag, and neither one of us would have it on me. I know what was, I can't remember the exact number I put in the bill, but the bill is based on my, the compensation's based on a bill from last year. I know, but it's, we're wasting time. The problem is a lot of the claims that existed in Pittston County were never acted on because they failed to meet the 24-hour requirement. So I'm not quite convinced that the number you're going to hear is what the number should have been.
I just don't like to hear it anyway. Just for
Commissioner Martin, would you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Martin. I serve as the Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Ag with oversight over the Plant Protection Division, and our agency actually does have the oversight of this program and the compensation. I just, I'll get back to your claims question on the amounts. I just want to let Madam Chair and the committee know that we have been in conversations on this subject. And we acknowledge that there are some problems with the claims process now. So we think this bill actually is a positive. It's probably, it needs some work still in terms of language, but there are some critical phases in the claims process. The first phase is when there is an initial kill. Who's going to do the initial investigation? And right now that involves extension, it involves DNR conservation officers, and it also involves USDA APHIS officers. And then the next phase in that process is you actually have to verify whether that livestock was killed by a coyote or a gray wolf. Compensation is only made for kills that are confirmed by wolves, not coyotes. So that's where you're looking for a different set of expertise. And if that wasn't complicated enough, then we get into the compensation phase where we need someone to set the value of that livestock, and that's where extension comes in. So as you see, this gets convoluted in terms of trying to sort out the appropriate people to be involved in the right part of the process. And I commit the agency to work with Representative Olin to clarify that more. And I realize this bill also brings in county law enforcement, which haven't been involved in the past. And we are also open to that, of involving county law enforcement in an appropriate way. But in a roundabout way, getting back to the claims question, right now we have $75,000 per year that we are able to pay out in wolf compensation. That fund is, I believe we usually get around 80 claims a year. They've been up in recent years because of wolf populations are increasing significantly, and there's more interaction between those animals. So it's $75,000 a year. I actually just ran the numbers not too long ago. From 1998, we've had over 1,000 claims and paid out $1 million. So it's a significant program. It's we have a good pass with it, but there's always times for room for improvement. And I guess we'll commit ourselves to working with the author in terms of any language that we could improve.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I hate to prolong the issue, but basically this is an ag, Department of Ag sent me this bill. I am handling the bill, yes, because it involves my district, but the bill came from the Department of Ag that I'm presently handling, and now they want to amend their bill. So,
I'm confused.
Madam Chair, to clarify, we did have a meeting with the state cattlemen's and also with the who were the sort of nexus of changing the bill. It's not an agency bill. We did meet with parties to discuss the options, but this wasn't part of the administration or an aging initiative, but we volunteered to work with them on it. So.
Any questions?
I wasn't involved in that discussion.
Are there any other testifiers?
No. In closing, I'd just like to point out that I was not involved in the discussion that they had involving my districts. I was not invited to be in this.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bruce Clay, Minnesota State Cattlemen. I think I missed something. I was over at the meeting with the State Patrol on anhydrous tanks, and so I told your committee administrator I'd be along here later. We were making an effort to try to include the sheriff, the local sheriff, in the observation, and that was our interest in the bill. We just took this and jacketed it. I don't know if it's the right answer, but I think there's another stop we can work on it. But our members were looking for help in the compensation.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Hi, thank you. My name is Linda Hatfield, and I'm with Howl, Help Our Wolves Live. And I just learned about this bill probably around noon today. And Howl opposes this bill because we think it's unscientific to allow an untrained person, such as a sheriff, to go out to examine, to do inspections on depredation sites. They don't know how to tell a wolf depredation from a coyote depredation or from any other animal depredation. We also believe that this bill would be a political conflict of interest, that sheriff would be out, you know, investigating his neighbor's property, his friend's property. How, you know, that would be kind of biased almost, because he is not an expert to identify wolf depredation. Also, Howell believes that this is in conflict with the state's wolf law, which was come up with recommendations of the Wolf Roundtable that met back in 98. And this certainly is not part of those recommendations. Inspections to find out if a wolf is responsible for depredation should be left to an expert. A CO officer who's been trained in the field, an agent of the Minnesota University Extension. This bill eliminates those individuals to do what they know best. They're experts. They're scientists. To do physical inspections without even any remains seems very unscientific to me. So I just want to go on the record saying that Howl does oppose this bill, and it should not pass. Thank you.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair, and I just want to confirm that as we look at subsection B, it's a conservation officer, APHIS, or county law enforcement officer shall inspect the site and report that inspection back to the commissioner. As we heard, step two is either conservation officer or APHIS. It is not a sheriff who determines whether the livestock was destroyed by a gray wolf. Then the commissioner shall authorize payment, step three, based on the extension agent's recommendation. So I just want to be clear that the sheriff is not making the determination whether this was by a wolf.
No.
The sheriff is simply making the preliminary investigation of the scene as a whole.
Any other questions? Any other testifiers? Representative Doty?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 3262 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is passed. Representative Anderson, welcome. Representative Doty, would you move the bill?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 797 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm good to be here. I'm doing pitch hitting here for Representative Emmer, who seems to have the Energizer Bunny inside of him and running hither and yon through the brambles and the bushes someplace. So I'm pitch hitting here to bring this bill forward. And basically, the bill has been, I'm sure, heard by many of people to classify equinines or horses as livestock. And I'm just got a gentleman who's I used to represent when I represented 19B over in the eastern part of Wright County, which is where Representative Emmer lives, citizen horse owner, Dave Dayon, to testify on behalf of the bill. And I'm looking for your comments and questions after we get done discussing it. So thank you, Madam Chair, for letting us have the opportunity.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, you saw this bill last year in the committee. We brought it back again, and we have an amendment. I believe one of the representatives has to bring that amendment to the
floor. Madam Chair, for purposes of discussion, I would move the amendment coded H0797810.
Any amendment? Questions?
No.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
With that amendment, this bill now has three sentences remaining in it. Two of those sentences are already listed in three other statutes currently in effect. So I would be open to any questions that you might have on the remaining language.
Any questions? Any other testifiers?
Madam Chair, just a point of clarification. This is going to Ag Finance, is that correct? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gloria Pinky, and I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessing Services. And I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. First off, the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers is supportive of House File 797. However, we would like to see the bill amended at some point in the progress to include a reference and clarify the language regarding the property tax treatment of horses. Last week, the Minnesota Department of Revenue did present their report to the property tax division here in the House on the study, the assessment and classification practices report, property used for horse boarding and breeding operations. And that report had some recommendations on how horse operations, boarding and breeding operations should be treated for property tax purposes. So at some point, we hope that the House will consider that. It's not referenced in the bill before you, nor is there any reference to property taxes. And so therefore, we are supportive of the bill as it goes forward, but hope that you'll consider and clarify the treatment of how these operations should be classified for property tax purposes. And with that, I'll stand for questions if there are any.
Any questions? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Pinky?
Yes.
In relation to property taxes and agricultural pursuits, is there a minimum standard for acreage to be classified agricultural?
Madam Chair and Representative Szymanski, in order to be classified as agricultural, there must be a minimum of 10 acres used in the production for sale of agricultural products. So 10 acres at this point is the statutory minimum, unless there are some qualifications, unless a property is intensively used and could be something such as vegetable gardening, that sort of thing. We can look at that.
Madam Chair, thank you, Ms. Pinky. I guess that was the answer I was looking for, was the intensive agriculture component of that for vegetables and so forth. I think that's essential to this consideration.
Representative.
Who cares about
apples? No apples.
Pardon me?
Do you want apples?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Speaker. And I believe your concerns, to the testifier, I believe your concerns were eliminated by passing the amendment. I believe that addressed the portion where your concerns originated from.
Madam Chair and Representative Hamilton, I think you're correct, but they had me come up, so I figured I better do my job.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other testifiers? Representative Doty.
Madam Chair, if there is no more testimony, I renew my motion that House File 797 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is adopted.
Madam Chair, thank you. And if you have any words of wisdom to pass on to Representative Emmer, I'd be glad to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had one comment for Representative Erdahl. It's gelatin, not marshmallows.
Thank you. Just a thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Anderson, I just want to compliment you on getting this bill through much more easier than what happened last year. Maybe just a different jockey was able to do it.
Representative Doty.
Madam Chair, I move that House File 3295 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is an agency bill from beginning to end, and so I will turn it over to Ben Chaney to discuss the bill, or whoever's going first.
Madam Chair, obviously I am not Ben Chaney. My name is Greg Bezicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and with me is Ben Chaney. I can walk through the first four sections of the bill as to what we're doing here on pesticides, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think Quinn will handle the remainder of the bill. And thank you, Representative Powell, for carrying it for us. Section 1 and 2 are basically corrections of some of a gap that was developed last year with the changing to the pesticide fee structure that we had. It basically changes the deadlines for the licensing period and for pesticide dealers in Section 1 and the new agricultural pesticide dealers. Currently, licenses are set to expire at the end of the year, but the new licenses won't be issued until after the report on pesticide sales have been provided to the department during the month of January. So this is a technical correction to correct that. It also changes the late fee and makes it more uniform to other provisions that we have in the statute, which is 50% of the application fee. Last year we had 20 pesticide dealers that reported to us late, and so we're estimating with the new program that we'll actually be doing a better job. And at $20 with 20 pesticide dealers last year, we brought in $400. This year we're looking at, with the change, only 10 pesticide dealers, so we'd be bringing in a total of $750. So it's minimal dollars, even though there's a fee associated with it. In Section 3, we're clarifying that instead of the use of the term private applicator, that it's clarified to deal with person. Person is actually a broader term, and that is, and the use of private applicator in that provision has caused some confusion, but it actually is a person can only purchase and use a restricted use pesticide. And finally, in Section 4, we're doing some clarification again because we're adding in the agricultural pesticide dealer to that provision. And at the same time, we thought it would be good to include very specifically that an incident response plan is required. The department has always interpreted storage handling and disposal, the storage handling and disposal plan, to include an incident response plan. And our rules reflect this, our bulk pesticide rules reflect this, so we thought we would clarify that at that time. And Madam Chair and committee members, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Representative Doby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at Section 1 and the B paragraph here about the increasing in the penalty fee, what kind of notification do these license holders get? Is it likely that they're surprised by this if we're going to jack up their penalty? Do they get notified, or is it a regular thing, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, yes. We do a mailing in November to all of our dealers that we have listed in our database, alerting them and providing them with the information to get back to us and do the notification. We license about 400 pesticide dealers, and last year I think we had a total of 20 that had a late fee associated with it. And Madam Chair, Representative Doty, this year, because we did such a significant change last year in terms of our licensing, we will be working very closely with the associations and with the dealers, letting them know how to get in compliance this year, because there's been such a significant change.
And a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. You sent out the notification in November. Does everybody's license come due then at the first of the year or about that time? Or the language here about before it expires, is there somebody that's going to expire on the 4th of July and he's getting that notice way back in November, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Doty, currently the licenses expire December 31st at the end of the year. With the change, what the industry dealers requested is that they have 1 month to compile and provide their pesticide sales use information to us. So that will be provided to us by January 31st, and that is a provision that is in another portion of the law. Their licensure is dependent upon providing that information to us. So it should be very clear that the license now expire January, at the end of January.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the department, the late fees that are collected, do they go to the general fund or do they stay in the department?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, they go into a dedicated account along with the registration fees and everything else we collect.
Okay. Madam Chair. Follow up. Then on the late fee collected, if you could once again tell why the need to raise that, and I tell you why I'm asking the questions. In one other department, we took testimony from an agency where the fines collected
went from about $90,000 up over $1 million. And all the fines collected are staying within the department. And so, again, could you just tell us the need to increase these fines or fees again, please?
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, the fees occasionally do change. And, in fact, this was an instance here where we had a $20 fee. That's relatively minimal, I think. And we're not trying to collect a lot of money on that. What we're trying to do is use it as a disincentive to have it have the everything processed at the correct time. So what we have done in the past is basically keyed it into the to the licensure, so it's 50%, and we've done that in other portions of the statute in on some of our other licenses in the past. So this is to make it uniform. I very quickly ran through some numbers, but at $20 late fee, we only had 20 people that were late last year, and so we collected a total of $400. This year, in talking with my staff, because of the changes, I asked how we're going to do on this, and they said, you know, we're probably going to have so much information out there that we're probably going to have more timely reporting of this. But they still said, well, maybe 10 people will be coming in. So we're anticipating an increase of about $350 in revenue from this provision. And I understand your comment about the huge increase, but we see this as pretty minimal, and just indexing it to the fee makes sense for us.
Thank you.
Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bozicki, I'm looking on the Section 3 on page 2. Item 3, Subdivision B, it talks about the a person may not purchase a restricted use pesticide without presenting a license card. Is that different than the private pesticide applicator certification? I guess I'm not quite sure what the license card represents there.
Madam Chair, Representative Shemansky, this would be a person who is actually licensed, which would be a commercial applicator or a non-commercial applicator. The certified private applicator card is the one that you carry as a private applicator.
Okay. All right.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Quinn Cheney. I'm the Policy Director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and I'll just talk through the rest of the bill. Section 5 has to do with the food handler fees that the department manages. This section enables the commissioner to waive the plan review fees when it's appropriate before licensing retail food facilities that are not primarily engaged in food business, like video stores, but maybe sell some prepackaged food. So all we're trying to do at this point is just to, they can be very minimal, and we just want to waive those, and our food inspectors can handle that as part of the initial licensing inspection process. Section 6 and 7 are some technical amendments related to the tuberculosis control zones terminology. USDA right now is considering changing it's the way that it handles the zones, and so we're just suggesting to disconnect our terminology that's in our statute from the USDA terminology, so that when they change their terminology, our program isn't negatively affected. We just want to be able to continue doing what we're doing in those TB control zones and not have it affected by what the USDA is doing. Section 8 would amend the corporate farm law to allow an exemption for nonprofits that are actively engaged in farming, as long as all the profits from the ag land goes for educational purposes. There is a limit on this for 40 acres, but I do understand that some of the groups that we would be doing this for are interested in having that expanded a little bit. The department's been approached by several different groups and individuals who want to capture the increasing demand of the public for locally grown food by using the nonprofit entity as a vehicle a small group of people to farm the land and also to create educational programs on farming practices. The last section is a repealer, and this repeals the Native Grasses and Wildflower Seed Production Incentive Loan Program that was created in the 1990s. This is a program that's never been funded, and we've not had any interest expressed in the program over the last 15 years, so we're just proposing, it's really more to clean up statute, proposing to eliminate it. And that's the whole bill, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Cheney. I'm turning to Section 8, so page 11, about the less than 40 acres part. I was wondering the same thing, why the acreage limitation and what policy that might achieve, and whether the department was open to either expanding the 40 acres or dropping the less than 40 acres language. I'm trying to understand why an acreage limitation is important if all the profits are going to educational purposes.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not quite sure I understood the question, Representative Morrow.
Well, I can give it another try. I'm just wondering what's the difference if on line 11.28 the words less than 40 acres were dropped.
If I can, Madam Chair and Representative Morrow, I think that, saying it's all going for education, that's great, but, you know, the larger you make it, the more objection I think we're going to get to it as it goes down the road. And so I would be comfortable keeping a limit on there someplace and rather than just opening it up.
Representative
Disfaust. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Faust and Ms. Cheney, I've got questions about the same section there. Maybe you can help me out with the context of what we're talking about. They're a nonprofit corporation. Does this mean these folks are not paying property taxes or other taxes on that property, I'm assuming? Is that's one of the questions. And then if that is the case, I guess I've got some concerns. I've got a township in my district that is largely owned by state and federal government, and then also has one or more nonprofits that own near 1,000 acres of land. There's not any land really left to tax and pay for the roads, so I'd be interested in the context of this one.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski, I'm not really an expert in property tax, so I guess I couldn't really respond to that aspect of it. But what I can tell you is that the department has come across some entities such as the Women's Environmental Institute and Farm of Plenty, which is in the Brainerd area, and they are relatively small. I think when we are talking about increasing it a little bit, we're talking about we're not quite sure. We're still working with the groups, but maybe something like 150 acres as opposed to 40 acres. And that's only because that those other organizations are about that size. But they are all of the profits from those organizations would be reinvested in education. And I don't know if that helps at all.
If I can, Madam Chair, I'm not a property tax expert either, but I don't believe that this will impact the property tax paid. Nonprofits, I believe, still pay property taxes. But I'm not, like I said, I'm not an expert. If anyone here knows for sure one way or the other, I'd love to hear from you for sure.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Faust, I know of at least one, and in the one in that particular township pays zero property taxes on the over 700 acres of property that they have tied up. And I don't know if it's farmed or not, but so that's why I'd like to better understand the context of what this means, and maybe I need to pull a statute book out and put the research into it.
Representative,
thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to be really clear here to both the author and Ms. Cheney. We're really only dealing here with 11.28 and 11.29 for changes in this entire section, right? We aren't changing anything else. I mean, we obviously, some of us are not familiar with this section very clearly, but we're leaving everything else as is, and we are only making that one small alteration in that section, correct?
Thank you. There's a change in 11.24 also, where 4 comes out, but that's it, those lines, that's it.
Madam Chair, if I might. Madam Chair, we do have an expert here on property tax who testified on a previous bill. Now, I did go around to ask, are all nonprofit corporations exempt for property tax purposes? And the answer is no, they're not automatically all exempt for property tax purposes. If we want a fuller answer, we could get one, but it sounds like there's a number of qualifications that come into play before a nonprofit corporation is exempt for the purpose of property tax. So if we want an answer, we do have an expert who could give us some guidance.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Morrow and Representative Faust. In order to be exempt from property taxes, there are many steps that have to be complied with. The property must be owned by a tax-exempt entity, and we look at a variety of information to determine whether an entity is exempt. A 501(c)(3) in and of itself does not make it tax exempt. So we look at that. We look at what it's used for. The entity has to verify to us that they need to own the land. They can't just go out and buy it and decide it's nice to hold it. So it has to be owned, used, and show necessity of ownership. And we look at Section 272.02 is really the property tax exempt statute. And last year, the legislature spelled out in statute it's called the North Star factors, and those are items that we look at closely for every entity who applies for tax exemption. In Dakota County, I can tell you we don't have any tax exempt nonprofit operations. Like, I believe this. I don't have a copy of the bill. I didn't know that anything like that might come up, but I can tell you, by being a tax-exempt entity as a 501(c)(3) is not an automatic exemption from property taxes. I can also mention that if the property is owned by a qualifying tax-exempt organization and that organization meets the requirements, but they lease it to someone else or to individuals who may farm that land, it's then taxable as personal property to the lessee. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different things that we look at before we give tax exemption. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. My name is Gloria Pinky, and I'm a manager in Dakota County Assessor's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. Thank you. Sorry.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Faust, this change of acreage, could this in any way impact like the University of Minnesota?
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I don't believe that it impacts the university anyway.
Okay. Just want to clarify that when you bring up education purposes. So, thank you.
Representative Owen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I think Representative Doty actually covered my comments that I was going to make, because we're not really debating whether this clause. In order to debate whether this non-profit corporation clause would be in or out, we'd have to have an amendment to remove it, because right now it is in statute.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, again, I'm Gloria Pinky from the Association of Assessing Officers, and if I could just comment to Representative Hamilton's question. The University of Minnesota owns about 8,000 acres in the center of Dakota County. Much of that land is leased to area farmers, and they pay a personal property tax for the use of that land, just like a farmer who owns a property in fee title. They also lease, I think, about 40 or 80 acres, maybe more now, to a tax-exempt cooperative owned by an association of Hmong farmers. And those acres are exempt because of the way their corporate bylaws are formulated and what they do with the land. So, again, it may or may not, I guess, is about all I wanted to offer.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions? Any other testifiers? Representative Doty?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion that House File 3295 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Aye.
No.
The bill is passed. We're done.